When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the development of the Maoist regime in 1949, the beginnings of totalitarian control and the crackdown on dissent, and how the police state was quickly established. As we know, from 1945 to 1949, there had been 4 years of a civil war that had been on hold throughout the period of the Second World War, China's Second World War, which lasts from 1937 to 1945, and the victory on the battlefield of the communist forces, with some help from Soviet Russia, had seen Chiang Kai-shek flee with the nationalists to Taiwan. So today we're reading from Frank Decota's The Tragedy of Liberation. It's the first part in his trilogy on Mao's China. The first actually published volume was Mao's Great Famine. This came second, but chronologically it's the first one. Frank Decota writes, "All over China, the police visited people suspected of being sympathetic to the old regime. In big cities like Beijing, Shanghai and Wuhan, special teams trained to take over public security arrived within days of liberation. After briefing by underground members of the Communist Party, they moved into precinct stations and police headquarters and ordered everybody to stay at their posts. General Chen Yi, now the new mayor of Shanghai, replaced his peaked cap with a dark beret, exhorting the police force in a three-hour meeting, an unlit cigarette dangling from his mouth. They should reform themselves and at the same time carry on their work without undue anxieties," he explained. "The communists had little choice but to ask former government servants and puppet policemen to stay on. In each department, the post office, the city hall, the police headquarters, some of the top officials of the old regime slipped away, and a few new faces appeared. These were the party cadres, charged with overseeing the takeover." So this seems to be a really pivotal moment in the establishment of the new regime, of a party functionaries attaching themselves to the normal bureaucratic running of everyday Chinese life. And at first saying that there's nothing very much to worry about, there'll be little change, there'll be mainly continuity, some of the more egregious aspects of nationalist rule and the kind of the hangovers from China's feudalism will have to be dealt with. But for most of you, it's really not going to be a big deal. Please don't worry. However, the Maoist regime, as it established itself, began to start to create some of the infrastructure of societal control. One eyewitness described the commissar class, the cadre class, that was emerging in towns and cities across China thusly. "The typical bureaucrat of the regime, in his blue or khaki uniform, like a soldier's, topped by a cloth cap, which he often wears even in the office, resembles a Soviet commissar much more than a Chinese official. He lives frugally, he is a poor man, and is clothed, fed and housed by the party. His tobacco and his soap are given to him on the official ration, and he hardly earns enough in a month to buy himself a pair of shoddy sandals. He sleeps on the floor and in a requisitioned European buildings. He rejects the soft mattresses that would prevent him from sleeping. He is distant with strangers, and apart from those few men who are appointed to deal with foreign relations, he is inaccessible. He insists that others, the other Chinese speak to him in the Peking tongue, now more than ever the official language of the whole country, and not in the local dialect of Shanghai or elsewhere. There are some really interesting things to say about that extract. This idea that the cadre is poor, that the cadre has to emulate these values of kind of almost like a Marxist asceticism, that they don't have material belongings, they're sort of not attached to the world through materialism in that way. Actually, this isn't true, and there were plenty of greedy and corrupt party cadres across China who ate very well during periods of famine, for example. Though for some, obviously, it would have been the case. There was the idea of sleeping on the floor. It has real echoes of the Russian revolutionary intelligentsia tradition of books like What Is To Be Done, which was Chernyshevsky's famous revolutionary novel, in which the hero hardens himself for the revolution. He doesn't have a private or a social life. He takes icy cold baths and sleeps on beds of nails to harden the body, to become almost like a machine for the revolution. And the attempt to present party cadres as just this, people who have no friends, who are distant with strangers, that they are really just units of revolutionary change. It was useful to the new Maoist regime that the nationalists had been building the infrastructure of control from 1945 onwards. They had been issuing identity cards to cities under their control, and they had been bringing these and imposing these on households. So a household could mean traditional family, but could also mean any collective unit, such as a factory dormitory or a hospital department. And as with the Stalinist takeover of Eastern Europe, the ID card system, when it was co-opted and appropriated by Mao, it begins to change, because the ID card system becomes a way of controlling rationing, controlling food. Eastern Europe is victim to Stalinism almost through the politics of hunger, by the state controlling the food supply. And the Maoists in China are little different. Food ration cards would now be interested to the head of each household, which could be a family head, a factory manager, the abbot in a Buddhist temple. And that would mean that the individual would be able to hand out food ration cards to everybody within the household. But also, those food ration cards could be withdrawn if there was any unreported change about that household. So this made the heads of households very eager to inform the police about any details whatsoever. And it inculcated a culture of information sharing, of upward kind of information transit to the state. The state was able very quickly, using rationing, using food, to start to enter into the private realities of the home, of the workplace, and other sort of social institutions and settings. This was also enormously bureaucratic. It took a huge amount of time, energy, effort, and paperwork to do, but it gave the state the sort of control that Mao knew would be necessary in order to bring about his revolution. It is interesting to consider here in the 21st century the social algorithms being employed by China under Xi Jinping, the kind of algorithmic control that Chinese people are soon going to be subjected to, and to look at the early days of the Maoist regime and see a kind of interesting synergies there. The next level of classification of individuals was to give them a class label, which would include their family background, occupation and individual status. And there were around 60 separate class labels, which were divided into general class categories. Those were ranked as good, middle or bad on the basis of their assumed loyalty towards the revolution. So, for example, good classes would include revolutionary cadres, revolutionary soldiers and revolutionary martyrs, industrial workers and poor and lower middle peasants. Middle classes would include the petty bourgeoisie, the middle peasants, intellectuals and professionals. Bad classes would be the landlords, the rich peasants and capitalists. And very quickly, two designations would eventually be created. Black and red, or friend and foe. To be assigned a black characteristic or a black label would shape one's life really until the end of the Maoist era, perhaps even beyond. As of course, children inherited the class status of their parents, class labels of their parents. Now, last week I did a podcast on the unpeople, or the former people, of the Soviet Union under Stalin, the enemy classes, who essentially are edited out of public and social life, who are disenfranchised, and who are marginalised. And much of the kind of the models for class persecution are acquired from Stalin by Mao Zedong. The members of the bad classes who were arrested first were heads of secret societies, war criminals, those who were leaders of the old regime, and the nature of communism being what it is, the kind of the paranoiac nature of communism, looking for class enemies wherever they might potentially be, meant that this sort of hunger for rooting out class enemies is transposed very quickly to the bad classes, the capitalists, the landowners, the former government officials. They become suspects as it's imagined that there are hidden enemies of the regime throughout China. One of the reasons for this continued obsession with security, with internal enemies, with dissent, and this overall paranoia, was the fact that the war hadn't quite ended, and the last parts of mainland China wouldn't be controlled by the communists until late 1950. The nationalists were able to control most of China's territorial waters. The nationalists had a monopoly on Chinese naval power, and they were able to use aircraft to bomb any sort of small boats along the coast of China, small junks and sampans, which had been assembled for a kind of an improvised invasion of Taiwan. It was popularly believed that the nationalists in Taiwan would reinvade the mainland at some point in the near future.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional.
Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The nationalists used commando squads to carry out special operations raids, and they used aircraft to drop arms supplies, food and ammunition to guerrilla groups, not necessarily all nationalist guerrilla groups, but those affiliated to them, across China, in order to try to destabilize the regime before it had even had a chance to establish itself. In order to control the cities, a curfew is declared. In Shanghai, cars were banned from the streets after 9 p.m. and pedestrians were banned after 11 p.m. Sentries were placed along every street corner, heavily armed, and newspapers and radio are co-opted by the regime very quickly, and were used to publicise these terrible activities of the enemy in order to bring about a state of constant anxiety. Now, of course, there would be plenty of people within China who didn't feel anxious at the possibility of the fall of the Maoist regime and very quickly began to invite it. But for a majority of people, even those who aren't supporters of the communists, what they do not want is a resumption of war. General hope is that no matter what follows, and people could not have predicted what Maoism would be like, but no matter what follows, that at least there would be no more warfare. A war in China, the Second World War and the Civil War that had killed between them perhaps 20 million, around that kind of figure, was such a kind of a profound scar, a profound burden on the collective psyche of Chinese people, that it made perfect sense that whatever Maoism represented, it was better than a return to war, and there were plenty of people who were happy to compromise with the regime if that's what it meant. So this culture of vigilance was in a way part of the desire by many ordinary Chinese people to not see further conflict. But it's also an indication as to what happens to a society when a culture of denunciation, of informing, emerges. There are those who very quickly, if we look at the examples of Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia, embrace the opportunity to appear loyal, to appear patriotic, to appear to be doing the right thing. The enemy was, in popular perception, the enemy was everywhere, was omnipresent. The common slogan in Tianjin in 1949 was, "Liberate the entire country and capture the people's enemy, Chiang Kai-shek, alive." So there was an encouragement that people would write to the police, write to newspapers, and neighbours begin to denounce one another, often in the anticipation that there'll be some kind of reward, or in a way of settling age-old disputes and feuds. which is often what occurs when you give people the powers of denunciation. They rarely use them in a benign way. The effect of this as well is that you get large numbers of people flocking to the Communist Party. Nobody wants to not be seen as a communist. Nobody wants their political origins and their class backgrounds to be questioned in any way. Now that rights are made conditional on class origin, the power that the state has becomes deeply sort of psychological. The state does not have to justify itself to individuals. Individuals have to justify themselves to the state. Individuals have to be good enough for the state to avoid frightening scrutiny. One foreign observer in Shanghai wrote, "Everybody claimed to be a guerrilla, a soaking red partisan." And those, again, who weren't able to claim this with any sincerity are visited by the police. They have their houses searched, their relationships with foreigners are questioned, the police are on the hunt for concealed documents or weapons, and people who own things like radios are suddenly viewed as being highly suspicious. So initially, mass killing doesn't begin in 1949. It is something that emerges throughout the period 1949 to 1958, the beginnings of the Great Leap Forward and the famine. But the Maoism, rather like Hitler's approach during his period of consolidation of power, was to proceed carefully, gradually, and to bring about more radical change only when it could be guaranteed that the regime was fully stable. That said, the scale of executions initially and the numbers of imprisonments initially begins to significantly grow. The most significant enemies of the regime were either jailed or were shot. Some were registered and interrogated and kept under surveillance, knowing that there would be the opportunity to revisit these individuals later on. In Shanghai, several hundred counter-revolutionaries, the kinds of the web of intelligence and support that the nationalists had in Shanghai were rounded up over the following months and shot in droves following December 1949. In Hebei province, away from the kind of the metropolitan centres, 20,000 suspects were executed in the first year of liberation. And sown across the country, in Hebei and in other parts of China, the killing rate would dramatically increase. It's interesting, again, one of these sort of synergies with Stalinism, the idea of doing it out of the way, of creating mass killing sites in remote places where they're not likely to be seen. Stalin was always at pains to make sure that there was as limited public exposure to the Gulag system as possible for those that didn't actually wind up in the Gulags. Of course, trains taking prisoners to the Gulags would often travel through towns and cities late at night to prevent there being any questions about who was on board the train wagons. A middle tier of suspect people of suspect class origins in 1949 managed really to go fairly ruffled by the revolution, by the Maoist seizure of power. They exist in a kind of a sense of a place of false security. Professionals, professors, bank clerks, lawyers, managers, doctors, engineers, were too important to the regime to lose. And also, these were individuals were going to be important, as Mao saw them, to
help build a socialist economy. Their treatment really is in trying to change their thoughts, trying to bring about new ways of thinking. They were sent to special re-education schools to re-educate them in Marxist, Leninist, Maoist thought. And in government offices, factories and workshops, schools and universities, people were given pamphlets, literature, books to look through and to learn the new doctrine. To some, it's a set of alien ideas they don't really understand, and they don't really get why they're being forced to think about them. And for others, they have a already some level of grasp of Marxist, Leninist, and Maoist thought. Mainly, it was a case of learning the right slogans, the right things to say, in order to keep out of trouble and to keep the state off your back. And here is where the term brainwashing actually first comes from. This brainwashing is a Maoist term. Frank Dakota writes, from Beijing to Guangzhou, cities became giant adult education centres. Banks, big shops and commercial offices had their own dedicated libraries. People were asked to transform themselves into what communists called new people. And here we've looked at this theme before, as the transformation of individuals into new socialist citizens. Those who had questionable pasts, questionable class backgrounds, had to write confessions and admitted all their personal faults, all their errors, all their mistakes. And so here is the kind of the embryo of the struggle sessions that we've looked at before. Sometimes these admissions would be enough. Sometimes they would be evidence that the person had really taken on board the new values and was changing their ways. Some had to be called forth for further interrogation in front of audiences. And this is, again, this is the beginnings of struggle sessions, where they're forced to recount every aspect of their life, every bad thing they ever did, for hours on end. And those who resisted could be worn down by endless debate. They would be bombarded with challenges by interrogators who would work in teams throughout the night to force the person to crack through mental exhaustion. Managers, academics who were guilty of having wrong thoughts would be made prisoners in their own workplace, locked in their offices, and visited by cadres and political instructors who would eventually break them. And every admission of guilt was, of course, added to a person's individual dossier, their individual file, which would be with them for the rest of their lives. Okay, so that's just the very beginnings of talking about the establishment of the Maoist regime. Next time, we'll continue and look at the way in which petty criminals were treated during the Maoist takeover. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.